whose course, Namaha, we offer our respects. Translation. The Prachetas spoke as follows. Dear Lord, you relieve all kinds of material distress. Your magnanimous, transcendental qualities and holy name are all auspicious. This conclusion is already settled. You can go faster than the speed of mind and words. You cannot be perceived by material senses. We therefore offer you respectful obeisances again and again. Why don't you say after me? The Prachetas spoke as follows. Dear Lord, you relieve all kinds of material distress. Your magnanimous transcendental qualities and holy name are all auspicious. This conclusion is already settled. You can go faster than the speed of mind and words. You cannot be perceived by material senses. We therefore offer you respectful obeisances again and again. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The word nirupita, meaning concluded, that's in the nirupitodara, nirupita udara, udara. The word nirupita, meaning concluded, is very significant in this verse. No one has to conduct research work to find God or make progress in spiritual knowledge. Everything is conclusively there in the Vedas. Therefore, the Lord says in Bhagavad Gita 15:15, Vedaischa sarvair, ahameva vedyaha, understanding the Supreme Personality of Godhead through the process of the Vedas is perfect and conclusive. The Vedas state, atat Sri Krishna namadi na bhaved grahyam indriyai, the transcendental name, forms, qualities, paraphernalia, and pastimes of the Lord cannot be understood by our blunt material senses. Sevan mukhe hi jivhado swayam eva sporatyada. When a devotee engages his senses favorably in devotional service, the Lord, through his causeless mercy, reveals himself to the devotee. This is the conclusive Vedic process. The Vedas also indicate that simply by chanting the holy name of the Lord, one can without a doubt become spiritually advanced. We cannot approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead by the speed of mind or words. But if we stick to devotional service, we can easily and quickly approach him. In other words, the Supreme Lord is attracted by devotional service, and he can approach us more swiftly than we can approach him with our mental speculation. The Lord has stated that he is beyond the range of mental speculation and the speed of thought, yet he can be approached easily by his causeless mercy. Thus only by his causeless mercy can he be attained. Other methods will not be effective. For the translation again, the Prachetas spoke as follows. You relieve all kinds of material distress. Your magnanimous transcendental qualities and holy name are all auspicious. This conclusion is already settled. You can go faster than the speed of mind and words. You cannot be perceived by material senses. We therefore offer you respectful obeisances again and again. So in the purport, Prabhupada begins by commenting on this word nirupita, concluded. No one has to conduct research work to find God or make progress in spiritual knowledge. But one has to take to the Vedic process. Everything is conclusively there in the Vedas. So sometimes Prabhupada calls our process of Krishna consciousness. Science, vigyan, process of realized knowledge. But here we see it differs in two significant respects from the process of material science, empirical science, as it is practiced today. And these are important. One, concluded. No one has to conduct research work to find God or make progress in spiritual knowledge. Gandhi wrote a book called My Experiments in Truth, and Prabhupada disapproved of this title as being inappropriate for an actual transcendentalist. There is no need to conduct experiments to find out what is the truth. Nirupita, it is settled. Krishna says decisively, Vedaischa sarvai aham eva vedyo. All the Vedas are just seeking after me. This is the Siddhanta, the conclusive final truth of the Vedas, that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this is settled. There's no need to put it forward as a hypothesis, to conduct experiments to prove or disprove it. That's settled. Why? Because it is coming down by the descending process. So in this way, whereas modern science is supposedly unsettled about it, what its ultimate conclusions are, it is supposed that in modern science everything is up for question. Of course, if you do that too much, you'll find yourself out of a job. But at least that's the doctrine. Understanding the Supreme Personality of Godhead through the process of the Vedas is perfect and conclusive. So there is a process, even though it is a settled conclusion that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Prabhupada nevertheless uses this word scientific to describe the Vedic process, even though in so many ways that it's not the same as modern science. Still, it is scientific. And what is that makes it science? Because those things which are revealed in the Vedas are also realized directly by the sadhaka, the aspirant, by his own experience. So it's not that you will come to some other conclusion than the conclusions of the Vedas, but you will also experience those conclusions by our own actually direct perception. Some devotees in this temple were having a discussion whether this word empirical applies to the process of Krishna consciousness. And in Sanskrit, the word pratyaksha is used for sense perception. Pratyaksha means before the eyes, before the vision. That which I verify directly is called pratyaksha. And that is rejected by the acharyas as a valid means of knowledge. Ultimately, the valid means of knowledge, there's pratyaksha, there's inference. What is inference in sense? Huh? Anumana, inference. And last, main category, shabda. Shabda, authoritative, descending knowledge from a hearing, sound, authoritative sound, authoritative description, Vedic knowledge. So the ultimate conclusion is actually the only valid source of knowledge is shabda, not pratyaksha, and not even inference. Unless that inference is grounded in shabda. If my process of inference is correct and all my premises come from shabda, then the conclusion is also valid, but not pratyaksha. But then we see in Bhagavad Gita, pratyaksha avagamam. gives direct perception, pratyaksha. Pratyaksha is there in Bhagavad Gita. And Jiva Goswami also speaks of vaidusha pratyaksha, the perception of those who are actually enlightened. And this vaidusha pratyaksha is actually the source of shabda. Sometimes, just as, for example, we can thank the Vaidusha Pratyaksha of Sanjaya for the Bhagavad Gita. It's his perception, is it not? His report of the conversation between Krishna and Arjuna. So the Vaidusha Pratyaksha. So there is direct experience, but it is it's too confusing to call it empirical, if you want to translate it. Prabhupada uses the word practical. If you like a more modern sounding word, you say experiential, but I would avoid empirical, because that means measuring. Empirical means measuring of mundane objects of the senses with your own senses, the empirical method. So, of course, the modern world and modern science, in its later development, denies any significance to anything other than the measurement of mundane senses. This doctrine is called positivism. You start out with simply an interest in the material world. Let us see how much we can discover by the measuring tendency of our senses. Let us see how long things are, how much they weigh, how far they travel, how fast they travel. Anything that we can express in numbers, that we are interested in. And in this way, one comes to build up a certain body of practically reliable knowledge, technical knowledge, not real knowledge, not vidya, but technical knowledge, like the knowledge of how to make shoes or build ox carts, knowledge of a trade. So this builds up, it's useful for its own purposes. But then later in history, in Western history, you got this development out of this doctrine called positivism. Because what happens is that when we get too involved with the measuring of our senses and for lording it over sense objects, we cannot any longer have any perception of transcendence. You see, there are these two tendencies are there with the human being, the soul in a human body. On the one hand, we can use the material senses that we have for lording it over sense objects. We weigh and we measure sense objects with the aim toward manipulating them to secure our material enjoyment. That's one activity. But we also have another ability, another kind of perception, which is the perception of transcendence, which is a different process. And it's part of the heritage of Western civilization that from the very beginning it knew about these two processes, and the whole thing is embedded, embodied in the writing of Plato, for example. How to attain spiritual vision and get direct perception of spiritual reality. There's practice also for that. And what everybody used to know is that if the senses became too involved, the more it came involved in this measure business for sense gratification, the less able the soul was able to perceive transcendence. And the more it got involved in the perception of the absolute truth the less interest it had, the soul had, for lording it over material nature and enjoying those sense objects of material nature. So this is common knowledge. Everybody knew these two things. But in the course of time, as Western civilization began to become more and more interested in material enjoyment and began to lose touch with transcendence, this is a historical process it went through, people began to forget. They began to deny the reality of transcendental experiences. They began to deny the reality of transcendental experience because they lost the capacity to have them. They lost the capacity to have them because of their absorption in sense gratification. And so this philosophy, this doctrine was developed called positivism. Comte, the philosopher, 18th century philosopher named Comte, was the one to coin the term. And it because still today, there was a big movement in philosophy in America and England, Germany, beginning in the 1920s, called logical positivism, which is a later development of this positivism. And the positivism is the tendency which says, sets up the method of science for the sole criterion, not only of truth, but of significance. Total loss of meaning, anything to transcendence. The positivistic doctrine is that for any statement, if some possible sense experience is not relevant to establishing its truth or falsity, then that sentence, that proposition, rather, they talk about proposition, that proposition is meaningless. See, so it's different. Like, you can take a simple sentence like, God is good. This is the kind of sentences they deal with. God is good, right? Oh, good, there is a God. Just to say there is God. Now, atheists, simple atheists would say, it's false. There is no God. Right? A positivist says, the sentence, there is a God, is meaningless. It has no significance. It's like gibberish. You can't even ask whether it's true or false. Because, they say, there is no way I could verify or falsify the statement. They had the criterion of meaning. First of all, the positivist came up, this is the logical positivist, came up with a verifiable criterion of meaning. Unless it can be verified by some possible sense experience, a proposition is meaningless. Right? This was a big, big school of philosophy in the West. Meaningless. Then somebody noticed that there's all kinds of propositions in science. Like all falling bodies accelerate at the rate of 32 feet per second per second. How are you going to verify that? Not unless you examine every single falling body. It's unverifiable, right? So, oops, made a mistake. Back to the drawing board. So then they came up with a falsifiable criterion of meaning. That because in scientific generalizations, the idea is that everything is falsifiable. And that while I could never verify, say, that all falling bodies on Earth accelerated at the rate of 32 feet per second per second. All I have to do is find one falling body that accelerates the rate of 15 feet per second per second, and I've shown the statement to be false, right? Therefore, that's the falsifiability criterion of meaning, right? But that's how you determine by your sense experience. Otherwise, so God exists. How would I go about proving it wrong? What sense experience would I have in this world when I go out with my tape measures and my pan balance and my odometers and trying to measure? How will I get a grasp on this sentence, either verify or falsify, that God, there is a God? No way. Therefore, it's meaningless. It has no significance. And then you say, well, a lot of people go around saying this, you know, sense. It means a lot to a lot of people. Well, yes, it has a kind of emotive meaning. It expresses some feelings that people have, but it's not really a factual proposition. This is the positivistic idea. The denial of any significance to transcendental experience. What this does is it says that anything... See, science can start out by saying, well, we're just going to consider what we can measure by our senses. But then it ends up saying that all that exists is what we can measure by our senses. And it's even meaningless to inquire whether or not anything exists. It's a waste of time. Now, this is the state of the modern world, of course. So here we are, we're in that environment, and we're practicing Krishna consciousness, and we've got a whole lot of stuff that they're not going to be able to... we're different. We have a different process. We accept the Vedas. And they say, well, how do you verify? But actually, of course, we can. It's not that experience is irrelevant. But we say, you can't. There's a whole realm of experience that is inaccessible to you because of your exclusive devotion to the measuring tendency of the senses for lording it over material objects. You can't. You say... The one word they use, they like to use this word metaphysical as a synonym with meaningless. Like God is a metaphysical proposition. This, the one thing logical positivism was supposed to do was put an end once and all for all metaphysics. You know, no more of this speculation about the absolute truth. Just finish with it. They're all due to mistakes in language, not understanding what has meaning and what doesn't have meaning, right? So God, the soul, all these are meaningless terms. They have no empirical referent. So the soul, for example, is a metaphysical entity. One philosopher wrote a book about the soul called The Ghost in the Machine. What is the soul? Well, the body is the clockwork. And what is the soul? Well, just some little bit of not clockwork, he said. Nobody knows what it is, what it does. It's just irrelevant. Not only the soul, but the mind, actually. Philosophical behavior. I'm trying to get rid of the mind, too. Another mind, soul, same thing for them. Minds don't exist. This is still going on. You speak about people's behavior, but not about what their minds do. It's behaviorist school. Anyway, they've lost this ability. They say the soul has no existence, metaphysical entities. But what they've done is, by promoting this philosophy, they've gotten people more and more engaged in the activities of sense gratification. And by having people getting more and more engaged in sense gratification, it actually causes them to be unable to have the kinds of experiences of God in the soul. So it's not just a statement that there is no God or there is no soul. What that does, it promotes the activities to make experience of those things impossible. Show me the soul. Well, okay, I can show you the soul. But we have a process for uncovering the soul. Here it is. Here's a process for uncovering the soul. But if right away you say there is no soul, there is no God, all you have is sense gratification, you better really get into it and do it up big while you have the chance. Then you're going to make that person totally unable to have any spiritual experiences. And the whole thing is going to sound like gibberish. But here we have a process, and it is scientific. It's different, in a way. And there's two ways. The first way is that already the conclusive truth is ascertained by authorities. Nevertheless, we can also verify it. Not falsifiable, but it is verifiable by our own experience. So here he says, Atasi Krishna Namadi Nabhaved Grayam Indriya. Your senses, your measuring senses, materially contaminated senses, you can't possibly grasp the transcendental nature of Krishna's name, form, etc. That's what it says in this verse too. Your mind, your speech and your mind can never go fast enough to catch this up. Incapable. You don't have the right tools. Somebody with material senses wants to examine Krishna. It's like giving somebody who wants to examine the planet Mars a microscope. Say, go ahead. It's useless. You want the right tools, to see Krishna, to apprehend Krishna. Here's how. You have to take to the conclusive Vedic process. Sevan mukhe hi jivado swayam eva sporatyada. Here it is. Take to this process of purifying the senses by chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Then you'll become capable. Your senses will become purified and you'll become capable of apprehending the spiritual form and so on of Krishna. So what's wrong with that? And in this way, it's not so different from what actually goes on in science. Now, let me mention this a little bit, that the actual conduct of material science is quite different sometimes than what is theoretically put out to be. Take this falsifiable criterion of meaning, for example. One experience can falsify. In fact, it doesn't happen. If you get a very well-established theory, like, say, the theory of evolution, which is actually a whole, what's called a paradigm, a whole way of doing science. Everything is built on it. Whole institutions are dedicated to it. If that theory were suddenly wrong, there'd be such an upheaval. Everything would be in doubt because so much is based on it, right? And everybody's working out of this evolutionary paradigm for explaining everything. And actually, as a matter of practical working, it's not falsifiable. The actual conduct of science is when you have something as well established as that, and there's the one case that can falsify it, and it comes up, it's set aside as an anomaly. There's a book published like this called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by a historian of science, philosopher and historian of science, who wrote this very controversial book about how science actually works and how paradigm shifts occur. Well, for example, we take the theory of evolution. There are published reports in reputable scientific journals that have shown, there's a couple of them, that people have found and accurately dated pollen in Precambrian rock. Pollen, fossils of pollen is found in Precambrian rock. Now, Precambrian is a very, very early period. In the Cambrian period, as far as they're concerned, there is nothing on the planet but shallow seas. There's not even any land plants at all. What to mention? Flowering plants which produce pollen. That's way, 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 way later. And yet here are these instances. This means that the whole description of what happened is completely wrong. It's totally wrong. The whole sequence of evolution is off. It's wrong. Just, in other words, nobody knows what actually happened. This is such a monkey wrench in the works. But these parts are not in the forefront of scientists' minds, because the scheme is still working well enough for most other things, so this little anomaly is set aside. This is what Kuhn says. They're set aside as anomalies. So actually, the theory is not falsifiable in any simple, straightforward way. What happens in the course is that if their anomalies pile up and pile up and pile up and pile up until there gets to be so many, so glaring and so obvious that everyone's freaking out, and still they don't change until there's a new paradigm to go to. So somebody's like rearranged everything and you can get some new picture of things that includes all these anomalies. That's the way it works. And these anomalies have been collected as a society for the collection of anomalies. And you can read page after page and page of these things, often involving evolutionary anomalies, like human skeletons in coal seams and all. There's tons of stuff like this. It just gets put aside because nobody knows how to deal with it. Somebody's gone and collected it all together, you know. And Sariputta's got these books. You should read them. Shakes your faith. So, at any rate, this is... how science is. So actually it's not falsifiable in any straightforward way also. Krishna consciousness, we have our Vedic process. We accept, yes, this is the truth in a straightforward way. There's no need. We don't have to keep getting new and new paradigms. We don't have to do experiments in the truth. We know what is there because it's descending. Because the absolute truth that we are after is not an it. It's not a thing. It's not a formula you can write on your t-shirt. It's Krishna. That's the absolute truth. Who is a person? And therefore, there it can be initiative from that side. And this is the difference also between Krishna consciousness and modern science. Is to them the absolute truth is inert. Also the impersonalist. It's inert. It's something you have to creep up on. One professor I had wrote a book called Raids on the Absolute. Didn't get very far. But here Prabhupada says, so our process of Krishna consciousness is not mechanical like a scientific process. It's not that I perform, or like a karmakanda, because science is just modern karmakanda. Karmakanda philosophy, you do a sacrifice, and the result would be there. And even if they were demigods, they had to follow the karma. They were obliged by karma also. And actually, if you analyze karmakanda religion, it's just another of those sacrifices. It's just like science. You get together, you muck around with the way the world goes by your sacrifice. Because what you do is when you make a sacrifice is you make a kind of a microcosm of the creation, and that allows you to manipulate the earth by your mantras and so on. And the gods are obliged to follow. This is the doctrine of the Karma Mimamsa. The gods are obliged. They have to follow their karma too. You force them. So it's mechanistic. It just works. You do something and you automatically get the result. Like modern science, you do some procedure and, you know, your precipitate comes out in your test tube. You can swirl it around. You get the results. But Krishna consciousness is not like that. That's what you think science means. If it's science, it doesn't imply that. No, because what it requires is the mercy of Krishna. We cannot approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead by the speed of mind or words. We can't get there. We don't have the apparatus. But if we stick to devotional service, we can easily and quickly approach Him, but not by our minds and our words. How can we? In other words, the Supreme Lord is attracted by devotional service. That's how. By following the procedure of sadhana bhakti, we do not compel Krishna to come to us, but we attract Him. We cannot chin our rounds and think that automatically I'll attain Krishna consciousness and somehow or other Krishna is left out of the picture. No, by chanting our rounds, we want to attain, we want to please Krishna. We know that Krishna is attracted by devotional service. So we are trying to become attracted to Krishna. We're not trying to actually see Krishna, to make ourselves in the kind of person that Krishna wants to see. So we can't approach Him, Prabhupada says, but He can approach us. more swiftly than we can approach him with our mental speculation. So we're trying with our mind and our words, we'll never catch him. But if he comes toward us, then all of a sudden that unbridgeable gap is taken care of like that. So it is the Krishna consciousness is the attempt to achieve the causeless mercy of Krishna. It proceeds by mercy. And if we forget that, by the mercy of Krishna, by the mercy of the spiritual master also. If I think that somehow or other I can approach Krishna, that's the way it works. We learn, first of all, even before we can deal with Krishna, we're taught, first of all, we have to deal with our spiritual master in the same way that Krishna's system is, that we cannot make advancement on our own. And that we have to achieve the mercy of the spiritual master. So this is not, you know, to get your results in your cyclotron, you don't have to get anybody's mercy. Except maybe the government. Give you the money to build your apparatus. But here we have to receive the mercy of grace of Krishna and Guru. Only by his causeless mercy can he be attained. Other methods will not be effective. So there may be so many methods. And if you use your methods, you may come up to the border of the Brahma Jyoti. But you won't attain Krishna. Krishna is attained when he comes. And he comes when he's attracted by devotional service. So we know this. We have experts. We know there are people who have attained Krishna. And they are telling us, this is how you do it. This is how you attract him. So this way also our process is unlike modern science. But Prabhupada calls it science. It's a fact. Because actually Krishna does reveal himself directly and fully. And we have so much testimony of that. And we can also perceive for ourselves in the ripeness of time. Any questions or comments? Yes? Yeah, you find an exception. There's that saying, the exception that proves the rule. But proves means, in that case, tests. Nobody understands anymore. Like a proving ground, it's the exception that tests the rule. That's what it really means. Yeah, you find one statement that falsifies it, then it's false. Yes? Subjective emotions. Well, they do that. There's hormones that are released in the bloodstream, and phronemes, and they measure that. Right? They're getting it down. They're going to invent the perfect love potion. That's what they're trying to do. Yes? Yeah, the mental hospitals are full of different people. So what do you say? Yeah, they can't understand us. That's already said. They think we're crazy. Prabhupada, you know, who is crazy? That's what Krishna says. What's light to us is dark to them, and what's dark to us is light. It's two different ways of being. They won't understand us. They can't appreciate. Only if there's some attraction can you initiate them into the process, and then everything becomes revealed. So that usually comes after great frustration with this process of sense gratification. Actually, you look at the whole empirical process. Of course, there's all kinds of foolishness there. It's incomplete. And actually, the falsifiable criterion of meaning didn't work either. As a strict philosophical school, it's passé. But still, the attitude is there. So we say right away, we just start people chanting Hare Krishna, give them prasadam. So it works. We're feeding an animal. They're swallowing the poison of sense gratification and the philosophy of this material civilization. So without their knowing it, we're giving them this antidote to this poison. We've got the antidote, comes from another world, and we introduce it into this systems of sound, whatever, that they have. And gradually that antidote works against that. That's the mercy of the Lord. And then when it starts to work, eventually, because they get a little bit purified, they come. They don't know why. They're attracted. They don't know why. I met this lady. Said, whenever I hear a chanting party, I try to follow it, but I can't keep up. You go too fast. Why is she attracted to follow a chanting party? Why? They can't say. So we just have to rely on that process. You should hear some of the theories all about what happens on the right side, speculations about the right side of the brain. You wouldn't believe it. You don't want to hear this stuff. They're going to be able to explain everything. Any other questions? Topic? In the beginning stage, there's a certain amount that works like that. The Krishna consciousness can, at least as far as the Brahma Jyoti, can work in an automatic way. Can at least relieve you of the modes of material nature. But if you want to go all the way, you want Krishna, then you have to take to the process. Otherwise, your chanting is not that effective. At a certain point in your chanting process, you're supposed to try to stop committing offenses against the holy name. It does, but you can call it empirical if you like. I just think it's a mistake because people mean certain thing by empirical. The way Prabhupada uses the word empirical is to refer to the experiences that people have by measuring in the material world. That's all. So it's just a matter of preferred mode of speech and the way Prabhupada has used that term. Best not get confused. Yeah. See, empiricism is a school of philosophy. David Hume, Berkeley, David Hume, Berkeley, Locke, and the whole science. You know, there's British empiricism. It's a whole school of thought. So you don't want to be confused with that. There's nothing in the mind. Their doctrine is, there's nothing in the mind that is not first in the senses. Everything that comes in the mind, there's no innate knowledge, there's nothing there to bring out. It all comes in. You're born in the world, it's a clean slate. I mean, do we believe this stuff? You're born in the world, it's a clean slate, and then from sense experience you get impressions and ideas, and that's where everything comes from in the mind. Well, it's a little simple-minded now, but, that simple form of 19th century empiricism wouldn't be, but there's still